America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. We've got a big infrastructure project going on in my community on what is called the Mixmaster, a series of looping highway structures that can position you going east-west or north-south. It's complicated, time-consuming, disruptive, and multi-millions of dollars over budget, even though it's a temporary patch for the next 20 to 25 years. The truth is, with infrastructure, most projects take longer than expected, cost more than was budgeted, and in the end, don't change behaviors to help avoid these costly repairs just a few years down the road. Our guest today on America Trends vehemently disagrees with the premise that the way we fund it is correct, even though politicians on both sides of the aisle can agree on little else, or that the stimulative effect on the economy is as dramatic as advertised. A contrarian view of infrastructure, today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Clifford Winston. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and he's done an awful lot of thinking about something that we've done an awful lot of talking about for a long period of time in America, and that is infrastructure. But let me start off, Clifford, because I know you think that a lot of the approaches that we're taking are probably ill-fated and not necessarily going to do for the economy what people think. But let's go back. First of all, why is it that we look at infrastructure and many of us can see glaring problems in our own community, whether it's roads or airports or rail or whatever it may be, and it's taken so long to get this conversation really going?
Okay, well, first of all, let's start from the top and ask ourselves, what is it we're trying to accomplish? I think, you know, too often what we see are people want to make policy, and you don't know what are you trying to solve. So let's start with that. Infrastructure usually involves some sort of capital facility to help with transportation, communication, and so on and so forth. And then the goal that society wishes to pursue is how do we make the most efficient use of that infrastructure so that it effectively maximizes benefits to society. That's really what we want to try to be doing. And for a long time, you know, the economics profession has laid out guidelines on how to do that. And those guidelines start with pricing the infrastructure efficiently. All right, so let me stop there if that point is clear.
Yeah, well, let me just ask. I mean, yeah. I know you say that, yeah. That's our goal.
Right.
But when I look at politicians making the determination as to what we're going to fix and what kind of infrastructure and the jobs that are going to be created and the projects that are going to benefit them the most, I don't think they necessarily are considering efficiency. I think they're considering what will work in their district or their state.
No question. They want to be reelected. This is always true. You know, this is not an unusual policy. I mean, the hope is that economists can try to sell particular policies in such a way that politicians might see that they are consistent also with them getting elected or reelected. But that can be difficult with something like infrastructure because what people see there are just the tangible capital construction. So you say, hey, you know, I built this road in the district, or I built this transit system, a rail system in the district, and you know, look what I'm doing for you, and you should elect me. You know, who cares if it's inefficient? Who cares if it fails a simple cost-benefit test? Obviously, that is the problem. But that said, you know, as an economist, I at least ought to set out the framework, and in my work, at least sort of point out, you know, what it is we're sacrificing when we ignore these economic considerations. But I will preview one other thing. I think, you know, as I've been doing this for quite a while, I also realize it's important to be constructive and think about alternatives. So even if my recommended efficient policies, which are not original to me, but certainly things I think economists agree with, do not seem to fly politically, is there anything else that I could say that might be constructive that help get to where we want to be given the political constraints? And I'll talk about that a bit later.
Okay. Well, let me go back to 2009, yeah. I believe it was. Yeah. And Joe Biden, I think, was really, tasked by Barack Obama with a jobs plan and some infrastructure build after the last economic calamity. And I had read varying accounts at one point, not recently, about how effective that was. I do know that I saw a lot of signs trying to say, hey, look at us. We are under construction because of the great work of President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden. And of course, in this case, Joe Biden is now the president. He put forward a plan. And I'm wondering, as an economist, where you think these plans come from. In other words, when we hear a number and then that number is negotiated down again, I mean, where are they getting these numbers for infrastructure?
Okay, so I think one thing that is very important to realize about infrastructure in the United States is that it has historically been shaped by an engineering mentality, not an economics mentality. Okay. And I mean by an engineering mentality, you know, a focus on expenditures on construction, whether it be new construction, which is obviously the most expensive, capital construction, new facilities, which is what we did for a large part of our history, and then maintenance of existing facilities after they're built. But there's always the pressure to provide new construction because that obviously is more sexy and, you know, easier to sell than just saying, oh, I've just fixed a few potholes. So that's really the mindset. It's an engineering mindset, and you see this all the time with American Society of Civil Engineers saying, we need to spend X trillion dollars, you know, to get the infrastructure up to, you know, standard. And what my point is that this mindset just ignores efficiency considerations, and that if we had an infrastructure policy that was guided first on, let's make the most efficient use of what we have. And we can do that by pricing. Then we would save a lot of money on expenditures, and performance would be much, much better.
But the civil engineers, you mentioned them, and I have done a podcast with them in the past, and I remember at the time, a couple of years back, I think their report card said that America had a D-plus overall for infrastructure. Now, they're looking at a range of things. They're looking at the roads, the bridges, of course. They're looking at the water systems. They're looking at dams, a whole range of things. And now they grade us as a C-minus. Now, is that something that goes into the consideration when politicians are up there arguing for a bridge to get them from Cincinnati to Kentucky? Is that what they're using?
Unfortunately, yes. I mean, in a broad sense, that they're looking for justifications for spending. All of them, I might add. This is a bipartisan effort. You know, the disappointing thing about Republicans is, although in theory they're supposed to be for limited government, they have done nothing, and certainly, you know, no more than Democrats, to try to promote efficiency and reduce expenditures. You know, they'll jump up and down about the magnitude, you know, when some bill is proposed, but the concept in trying to get the expenses down and have the policy more efficient, they contribute nothing. So it's really a bipartisan effort, And they're just looking for support. So when the engineers say, we need to spend X billion dollars or our bridges will fall down, they'll jump up and down and say, yeah, we got to do that. So they'll draw on it. I don't know if they explicitly, you know, read an ASCE report and that influences them, but the word is out. And I think that contributes to the mindset of, again, spend without asking, can we do this in a more efficient way?
Well, in Barron's, you and Trevor Gallen wrote a piece called The Wrong Way to Pay for Infrastructure. And I think you've expressed yourself basically on the fact that that's how we do it from a public policy standpoint. You say that the important economic effects of this package should not be ignored. If passed in its current form, the increased government spending in the legislation may raise U.S. gross national product, but the package will hurt the economy by initiating a costly and lengthy transition to build new taxpayer-funded infrastructure. So someone listening will say, well, I mean, isn't it all crumbling? Don't we see that we've got pipes and water problems that have been so explicit in communities like Flint? Don't we need more broadband? Whatever it may be, what's your argument?
Okay, I'm certainly not saying that we should ignore, you know, physical symptoms of inefficiencies, right? You don't have an efficient system when you have potholes and you're damaging vehicles and you have bridges that are falling and infrastructure is not telecommunications is not reaching people who would value it. All those things are signals that something ought to be done. The question is then, how do you do it in the most efficient way? And that is where pricing comes in. So, for example, what really is the source of potholes? What is it that contributes to roads falling apart? Well, let me give you a surprise. It isn't cars, it's trucks. It's overloaded trucks are what do the damage. So what should be done is, instead of getting in a race, which you will not win, of continuing to spend money to strengthen the roads, because, you know, we'll have more trucks and they'll continue to do more damage, why don't we give an incentive for trucks not to do as much damage as they do to the roads?
Mm-hmm.
And the way you do that is with a price mechanism. So you charge what are known as axle weight charges. In other words, you encourage trucks to use more axles that spread out the pressure of the truck and what they're carrying on the road, which is what damages it. And if they do that, then they do inflict less damage, and then there's less maintenance, and obviously the roads will last longer. But you need to say, okay, we're charging you now by what we call axle weight. Instead of what we do now is we charge you by the gas tax, which is perverse. So what's interesting about that is, you know, a gas tax encourages you to get a truck to get better fuel economy, right? Because if you get worse fuel economy, you pay more, right, and higher gas taxes. And that's exactly the opposite of what you want. You actually want them to get less, in the sense that you have an extra axle that will make the truck heavier. It will get less fuel economy, but it will do less damage to the road. And that's just one example. You know, another obvious one is congestion pricing. Cars are the ones that, you know, put pressure on capacity of the road. And the ideal thing is to have them spread out when they use the road, so only those people who really have to go at peak travel times go ahead and do it, and they're willing to pay for it and value that. And the others can, you know, either go at different times, use different routes, different modes, so on and so forth. Okay, that's the idea of congestion pricing. You do both of those things, you don't have to spend a dime on capacity and durability. That's durability is the thickness to make the road strong against the trucks, right? Pricing is doing the work for you. Now, that said, this does not mean that we shouldn't spend more. We probably should and could. All right, but at least a lot of the work is already done. And with pricing, you're getting the right signal as to where additional investment ought to be made. Because it could be the case that we put in congestion prices and we really don't need to expand the road with a very expensive new lane. Congestion pricing seems to be doing the job. So that's another thing. And then finally, revenues. You know, this is an efficient way to raise funds because you are charging the people who are using the road for using it. And that's fair and efficient because that's how you're raising revenues. So that's, you know, the general perspective on pricing. It's meant to be a very valuable tool that can work with investment. But it, again, it makes it so much easier if you include.
Well, let me ask you, would it be a good idea, given that we haven't done that in most cases? There is some of that going on around the country, and you can talk to how well those purposes have borne out. But let me ask you, if in fact we do agree that there's now some very potted roads and lots of issues that have to be addressed, what about doing that and at the same time beginning to implement these kinds of policies for the long term? And let me give you one example. I live in Connecticut, and one of the most congested parts of the eastern block here is I-95 in Fairfield County going into New York. And I used to argue on a radio program that I did that one of the ways they could more inexpensively begin to address that, because they talked about an added lane, they talked about a double tiering of the highway. I mean, certain things that are wildly expensive and, as you say, would take decades really to complete. Why not just take some of the exits off of I-95, because everybody got their favorite exit. So everybody's using the road as a local road as well as an expressway. I mean, there are things we can do, and the congestion pricing and such, but what do we have to do at least to repair the damage we've done?
Sure. I mean, but what I'm suggesting does that. I mean, in the sense that pricing will help fix things, right? Because it will discourage trucks from putting in these potholes and damaging the road, right? It will discourage vehicles who really don't need or value peak travel period from making other arrangements. So we are making progress in that respect. And then one could go ahead and ask the question, after doing that, you know, what kind of additional investments make sense from a cost-benefit perspective. I would quickly add that closing off the exits, that again is an example of you're going ahead with a policy, but you're not. You need to back up and ask, okay, what are we trying to accomplish? Again, we want to see throughput on the road that is generating benefits to users, mm-hmm. and they need to just so have the incentive to use them in such a way that they are paying the cost when they use them. And that's our big problem.
Right. But if we want to get them off the roads, or at least restrict the times of day so that it is less impactful, what about having to fix other aspects of the transit system? For example, in Fairfield County, I'll just reference that again, trains are such an important part. And could that be made more efficient so that we try, as a public policy, to move people onto mass transit rather than individual transit? I know for years we've tried to get people to drive together. I don't know how you think that has worked from an economist standpoint, but I don't see much activity in that area today.
Okay, so first on the cars, you know, again, one would like to have incentives. So it's conceivable that congestion pricing of the sort that I'm talking about could provide an incentive for people to carpool more often than they do now, to the extent they could share the expense. But then that decision has to be made based on, you know, their own utility or welfare, if you will, and their partners' utility and welfare. And, you know, my guess is you probably get a bit more use, but probably not that much, because it is sort of inconvenient to have to travel with other people. But at least you give them a chance to respond efficiently by setting up the incentives for them to do so. Now, other modes are unfortunately something where I've got a policy and you're not thinking through what it's going to wind up doing. Urban transit has been just by and large an outright failure. It's extremely subsidized and the use of it continues to decline. So even with its subsidized prices, changes in demographics are making it just very, very unpopular modes. I mean, before the pandemic, more people were telecommuting than were using transit. You know, after the pandemic, it's probably even going to be worse as more people continue to work from home. So unfortunately, transit is not the answer, but at least you've opened up at least the discussion to a possible answer that is a different mode, autonomous vehicles. Mm-hmm. If we want to look at a way that could actually be constructive and does not raise a lot of the political problems with the efficient policies that I mentioned, but it's to the extent, if anything, it actually shows a way that these efficient policies could be implemented, autonomous vehicles are the answer. And the reason is because they directly reduce congestion and will improve safety and have very broad effects on the overall economy. They also will make much better use of the existing road, and you could actually even change roads. Right now, the number of lanes that exist on roads is built for high-speed, free-flow traffic. So they're wide lanes to accommodate vehicles. Mm-hmm. You could actually have narrower lanes and more lanes with autonomous vehicles because they'll drive more under control. And those people who say, yes, but autonomous vehicles will lead to more people using cars, and that will increase congestion, not quite, because about a third of all delays are due to what we call incident delays, that is, accidents. And autonomous vehicles, really, once they're working well, will not get into accidents, be very, very rare. And so you will not even have that big, important source of delays. Now, just to quickly preview, I said, well, autonomous vehicles might encourage efficient policies. Autonomous vehicles are really an area of global competition and even state competition. That is, the world will see who succeeds in adopting these things, how successful they are, and everyone will hear about it. Beijing right now is planning on autonomous vehicle roads, whereas we're still messing around trying to figure out testing procedures. This is something that is going to attract the attention of American policymakers. Individual states differ dramatically in how they're preparing for autonomous vehicles. Okay. One thing autonomous vehicles don't like are potholes. You put autonomous vehicles on the road and they come across a pothole, they don't know quite what to do with it, one. And two, whatever they're going to do, it's going to disrupt the traffic flow, which is the whole idea of autonomous vehicles, having a smooth traffic flow. So this might encourage policymakers to say, hey, we've got to do something that reduces potholes. Now, you can say, well, we'll spend money to do it, sure, but we know how wasteful that can be. Might be better if we set in axle weight charges and encourage trucks to do less damage to the road. So that's just a preview of where this could go if we're really serious about improving infrastructure and trying to, you know, deal with the fact that politically it's very hard to get efficient policies in the minds of policymakers.
Post-pandemic, let me ask you about two factors. You mentioned autonomous vehicles, and I know I did a podcast where the argument was made that this is really going to have an impact on the delivery economy, that you're going to have all of these autonomous vehicles rolling around at off hours, and that will be the greater use of autonomous vehicles going forward. The second, I want to go back to what you said about telecommuting, because post the pandemic, if the basic approach is going to be hybrid, and I'm only going into the office twice a week rather than five times a week, what do we then project from a public policy standpoint? Do we invest more in broadband, and do we not invest as much in the roads, or expect that the roads will be less encumbered going forward?
Well, again, on the latter question, we pursue efficient policies. Ideally, if I want to provide guidance, again, we want to set efficient pricing. After we've done that, we do cost-benefit analysis of whether particular investments are worth doing. But I might also add that these are things that have to pass whether it's worth the public sector doing this. You know, a number of things the private sector can do. Well, let the private sector invest in broadband. You know, they can do that, and there's huge payments, payoffs for them from doing it. You know, let's also then look more constructively at private sector incentives. You know, why can't they do this? So that's a broad template for, you know, policy analysis, you know, when we go to the pandemic. Now, your point about what's going to happen in terms of deliveries, that is true. It is probably the case that we will see much greater use of autonomous trucks and shuttle vans and the like before we see autonomous cars. And again, referencing China, you know, they were making use of autonomous vans during the pandemic to deliver supplies and to obviously promote social distancing. So the use of autonomous vehicles can be really important in future pandemics, and ideally it'd be great if we had them now, but it's still going to take a while. But that's going to be a very important part is in the delivery area and in trucking, where, again, there's motivation, concerns about a shortage of drivers, and obviously always concerns about safety. Autonomous trucks can be very helpful in that regard.
What about freight and rail? How important a consideration is that to move things off of our roads altogether that have the greatest weight bearing and impact on the roads?
Well, I think in the case of trucks, again, let's get the prices right. So the question you ask is, if we set efficient prices on the modes, what would be the allocation of traffic? And obviously the roads are concerned about this issue. And there may be some shifting to rail if we did that, but I also think autonomous trucks are going to have a major role to play, and it is not beyond one's imagination for the trucking industry to say, look, we're interested in autonomous truck-only roads. We don't want cars on them, and we'll pay for them, and we're going to run much bigger fleets than we have now. So it won't be like doubles or triples, your triples you'll see in the West. We'll have like almost long caravans of trucks that'll be like railroads. And we'll take everything that they take, you know, even coal. And railroads may be in for one hell of a competitor if that comes to pass. So I put that in because a lot of people now are focused on issues with rail, about regulations of rates and all this kind of stuff. And they're not looking ahead. This is a mode that may very well have to fight for its survival in a world of autonomous trucks. So these are the kinds of issues that arise if you open up your horizons. And I haven't even mentioned what drones can do. So there's a lot of room for excitement in transportation if you focus on innovation and technological change. So I'm trying to encourage efficient policy.
Okay, so how much of that, or this forward thinking, and that's what we do on this particular podcast, looking at social and political trends, has gone into any of the construct of any of the plans, whether they've been upsized or downsized, that we're looking at related to infrastructure in America?
0.0. The mindset is still this engineering mindset of spending money. It hasn't evolved for decades. Yes, there's a little bit of discussion about pricing, and you know, people are jumping up and down because New York may finally implement a congestion pricing program, but you know, it's the only one that'll have done it. Two, it's not clear to me yet how successful it will be because I do not even know what their pricing strategy is going to be. It may not be well done. And three, they're going to use all the revenues to put it into the transit system, which is, as we know, is highly inefficient and not necessarily the best use of those revenues. So I think for the most part, we really do not see, you know, the kind of innovative thinking that is possible, especially as the transportation system motivated by the private sector is trying to change. You know, we're just not getting the cooperation and leadership from the policy community.
Let me go to climate change and electric vehicle infrastructure, buses, transit. I saw the Transportation Secretary, Pete Buttigieg, who seems like a forward-thinking guy. I would think that a lot of this is on his radar, but maybe I'm wrong. But how important is the consideration as to the impact of whatever we build, rebuild, construct, deconstruct, as it relates to climate change?
All these things are relevant, but again, you know, the template that, I laid out still applies. That is, you want to have your goal is, let's try to reduce damage to the environment. First, start with the price mechanism, right? We first want to do that. Charge people for emissions, right? Electric vehicles still should be charged because they're going to make contributions to congestion and their issues of safety that they can
charge. Yeah, which the Genet tax does not do.
Absolutely does not do. And, you know, they too, there is emissions and contribution to environmental degradation and obviously the production of EVs. So again, we start with that and then we look at investments, cost benefit, if it's the public sector, but most importantly, especially in this area, we look at the private sector, who on their own is obviously exploring ways to improve the environment. Obviously, they're the ones who are pushing EVs, and subsidies and the government never really helped all that much. They tried to do that with American cars, and the Japanese cars are the ones that raced ahead in this area. And of course, then things like carbon capture and so on and so forth are coming out of the private sector. So I think all the things that I've been saying, again, apply if you want to switch things over to the environmental area. But again, policymakers are really getting in the way.
In closing, and this is right in your bailiwick, Jason Furman, very well respected former chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, has dismissed, in your article you point to this, concerns about paying for the package because it includes long-term investments that will pay off over time. And you put, except if they don't. And obviously, in terms of the discourse today, you have dramatic questions about whether they pay off over time and whether we're even going in the right direction long term.
Well, you've actually answered this yourself when you talked about, you know, construction that goes on in the Connecticut, New York area, right? Backing up traffic. They have what they call work zones, you know, that'll close a lane, reduce speeds, so on and so forth. But,
yeah,
you know,
that's only for 10 years.
That's only for 10 years. Let's talk about the 10 years before that that you didn't see when the engineers had to go through the environmental impact programs, you know, had to get through the political process of making sure squirrels aren't having to move their, you know, habitat, you know, so on and so forth. I mean, the amount of time that these things can take is enormous. And of course, we haven't even talked about the cost overruns, right? These things just turn out to cost a little bit more than we thought they would. And when you put us all together, you know, it's not clear, you know, how these investments turn out in terms of their rate of return, because they've turned out to take much longer, be much more expensive, and cause a lot of havoc, you know, while we're waiting for them to be complete. That is why, again, efficient policy is so important. You do not have to wait forever and go through engineering reports and, you know, have cost overruns. If you just set efficient prices, you could do that tomorrow. And you actually can do it now quite accurately and even minimize the cost of collection. This is why, you know, we're getting closer to doing it because of innovation, but it's still further and further away in terms of the political environment.
Okay, before I let you go, there are some examples of where this is being attempted, correct?
Oh, throughout the world, sure. Absolutely.
No, but I mean, even in the United States.
You know, I mentioned New York. We do have HOT lanes in this country. These are these high occupancy
right.
traffic toll lanes, so you can pay as a solo driver to go on a carpool lane. They exist, but again, it accounts for a tiny amount of the traffic. Mm-hmm. The same thing, you know, there is private sector involvement in new construction. Right. But again, it counts for a tiny amount of the traffic. Let's not oversell it. And I think my main point is it's just not sort of the working tools of policymakers. you know, it'd be one thing if these just weren't rare examples, but the first thing that people do when they think about setting up an infrastructure policy, they say, how do we set up efficient prices, right? Well, that's probably something that they'll never do. But I pointed out there are huge costs to that kind of mindset, but I'm concluding in optimism that autonomous vehicles might be the way really to address the problem.
Well, it's interesting. When I was looking at the White House statement, the fact sheet, proposed financing sources for the new investment, I'm sure going to love these. Reduce the IRS tax gap. I understand what that means. Lots of people are not claiming or corporations what it is that they owe, and they have a hard time running it down. Unemployment insurance program integrity, redirect unused employment insurance relief funds, repurpose unused relief funds, allow states to sell or purchase unused toll credits. I mean, everything but anything you're talking about.
Right. Yeah, anything but. And again, they're making taxpayers pay for this stuff, and not all of them are necessarily rich taxpayers. I have no problem with trying to tighten up, you know, the IRS, tax avoidance, all that kind of stuff, fine. But that has nothing to do with infrastructure. I mean, that's what's so frustrating. Look, you have a clear objective and a clear policy, right? Set up prices that directly are charge users to raise the revenues to finance the infrastructure. It's not that complicated. Don't look for all these other things to pay for it. You can certainly improve on those things for other purposes, but you've got to have a focus. I think that really maybe sums up the problem with all these other things that are brought in. There's just nobody there that seems to focus on what we're trying to do and the most efficient ways to do it. I have tried to reach out to the current secretary, but, you know, radio silence thus far.
Interesting. Brookings Institution is very well respected. I'm wondering if other think tanks, because this certainly has an attraction, I would imagine, for the American Enterprise Institute and others. Are you guys not called in on these things?
I can't really speak for them, but I certainly am not.
Interesting.
Yeah, we've had meetings with them. I mean, in other words, you know, let me point out, Jim Peterba at MIT and Ed Glaser at Harvard have run an NBER, National Bureau of Economic Research Transportation Program, and they even invited the secretary to kick off the program with a speech. But, you know, after he did that, it's not clear that, you know, he stayed around or anything resonated with him. So there have been opportunities led by other economists, but it's tough, obviously, to reach these people, especially on this issue.
Yeah. Well, you need to offer a better lunch, I guess. Well, Clifford Winston, pleasure from the Brookings Institution. We're talking about infrastructure, and perhaps not in the way that you hear it discussed in many other places, but you do here on America Trends. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.